Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.22, The Third Army of Macedonia. In September of 1907, Mustafa Kemal, the future Ataturk, was finally transferred from the 5th Army in Syria to the 3rd Army of Macedonia. Kemal had been trying for over a year now to arrange this transfer, not only so that he could be stationed near his home in Salonika, but also, and really mostly, because he hoped to play a leading role in the conspiracy that was quickly developing within the 3rd Army. When Mustafa Kemal reached Macedonia, however, he found the situation to be quite different than when he had left a year and a half earlier. When Kemal recruited several members into his Fatherland and Freedom Society back in early 1906, he had been on the cutting edge of the revolutionary movement in Macedonia. But then, he had been sent back to serve in the Middle East for over a year, and upon returning home in the fall of 1907, he found that all of his comrades in Salonika were now members of the Ottoman Freedom Society under the leadership of the revolutionary mailman Mehmet Talat. And Talat's group was also currently in the process of merging with the Committee of Union and Progress operating in Europe. So, even though Mustafa Kemal had been one of the first people to establish a patriotic committee in the Balkans, during the time he had spent on duty in the Middle East, he had clearly been left behind. So, instead of emerging as a leader within the revolutionary movement, something he very much desired to be, Mustafa Kemal would simply be one amongst hundreds of other junior officers joining the CUP in 1907. When he was inaugurated into the CUP, likely around October, Kemal was forced to endure the usual mystical initiation ceremony with spooky candles and hooded figures in red cloaks, and with Kemal swearing an oath of loyalty with one hand on the Quran and the other on a pistol. When the future Ataturk became a member of the CUP in the fall of 1907, he was joining the secret society alongside hundreds of other army officers, similarly hopping on board with the patriotic movement. And as more and more young officers living in the Balkans joined up with the CUP, the imperial structures that governed Macedonia would quickly begin to break down. And in the bars and cafes of Macedonia's cities, specifically Salonika and Monastir, junior officers and rank-and-file soldiers began to meet and drink and plot what needed to be done to save the Ottoman fatherland from the wolves of European imperialism and from the jackals of Balkan nationalism. And even before the onset of the revolution, many of these junior officers would begin to build little revolutionary mythologies around themselves, and they would come to see themselves as, quote, great men of history. As we have noted, because he had missed the developments of 1906, Mustafa Kemal would himself not be one of these great figures of the revolution, and he would largely be overshadowed by other people who would play a much more important role in forcing the Sultan to reinstate the Mithat Constitution. We've already introduced many of these figures, the most important being the early leaders of the Ottoman Freedom Society in Salonika, Talat and Javid, as well as Dr. Shakir, Dr. Nazim, Ahmed Reza, and other exiled leaders of the CUP who had been working hard to reorganize the Young Turks in exile into a truly revolutionary party. But what you may have noticed is that all of these people were civilians. However, junior army officers and the military more generally would play a key role in transforming the revolution from being a faraway dream to being an actual established fact. And for the Ottoman public, these military heroes would be the face of the revolution, and figures such as Talat and the political doctors Nazım and Shakir would largely remain in the background for the moment. So today we will meet the two revolutionary officers whose mutinies would precipitate the revolution, the officers who would come to be dubbed the Heroes of Liberty, and who would emerge as the most visible icons of 1908, Ismail Enver and Ahmed Niazi. In telling the story of the radicalization of the Third Army of Macedonia, we will begin by introducing the most famous officer of the revolution, who would sit right alongside Talat in the years leading up to World War I as the de facto dictators of the empire. The man who I have heard described and who thought of himself as the Napoleon of the Young Turk Revolution, Ismail Enver, later to be known as Enver Bey and eventually Enver Pasha. Ismail Enver was born in 1881 in Istanbul, but as a young boy at the age of 6, Enver moved away from the Ottoman capital to live with his father in the city of Monastir. Now, you may recognize the name Monastir from episode 2.18, the Ilinden Uprising, because Monastir was the province where the MRO initially launched their uprising in 1903. So, Enver grew up within the heightened atmosphere of the Macedonian struggle, and his early life was stamped by the interethnic violence and just generalized chaos of the ongoing guerrilla war being fought amongst Christian revolutionary groups. Enver was, in many ways, destined from birth to become a military man. As a boy, he attended military prep schools in Monastir, and then as a teenager, he would be accepted to an elite Royal Military Academy in Istanbul. Enver excelled within these military schools, and he was put on track to become a general staff officer, graduating second in his class in 1902. After graduating, Enver was sent back home to Monastir, where he joined the Third Army of Macedonia as a staff captain, and he was ordered to field duty. And since Enver was dispatched to Macedonia in 1903, the year of the Ilinden Uprising, what field duty meant for Enver was combating the Christian guerrilla bands, who were leading mass revolts of Christian peasants, as well as just like robbing and pillaging Muslim villages with impunity. So, over the next 5 years, between 1903 and 1908, Enver fought dozens of engagements against Christian guerrilla bands, and he, much like Talat and Dr. Shakir, would develop a grim respect that was also mixed with bitter resentment towards these Christian revolutionaries, especially the Macedo-Bulgarians in the MRO. As an ambitious, patriotic, and highly educated young officer, Enver epitomized the type of recruits that the Ottoman Freedom Society, and later the CUP, would target as they expanded their revolutionary network. As we have noted, Enver had been a classmate of Mustafa Kemal's at the War Academy in Istanbul, and both men were involved in seditious underground activities as young cadets. And then, after he had joined the Third Army in Macedonia, Enver began to hear about a revolutionary mailman named Talat who was up to some pretty interesting things down in Salonika, and Enver would establish contact with the Ottoman Freedom Society in 1906. Because Enver had begun to make a name for himself as a brave and intrepid fighter battling the Christian guerrilla bands in Monastir, and because he was one of the first junior officers to join the Ottoman Freedom Society, Enver quickly emerged as a critical figure within the revolutionary movement of Macedonia. And this was largely because Enver was stationed in Monastir, and Monastir was the administrative hub of the Third Army. So, Enver would become the primary point of contact between the Sacred Committee in Salonika and the revolutionary officers of the Third Army in Monastir. Now, one thing I want to note regarding last week's episode on the Sacred Committee is that following the revolution, the term Sacred Committee would be used quite regularly to describe the CUP as a whole by the organization's members. But from what I can tell, the central committee in Salonika that would emerge under Talat's leadership did refer to themselves as the Sacred Committee before the revolution and before this term was used more broadly to refer to the entire CUP network. And, well, this moniker is easy to remember and it kind of just sounds cool, so I'm just going to keep using the term Sacred Committee to describe what was essentially the central committee of the CUP in Salonika that would come to operate much like the Politburo in the Soviet Union. So, Sacred Committee, the term would come to be used to describe the CUP as a whole, but I am using it to describe the central committee in Salonika under Talat, Nazim, and Shakir. Wanted to make that clear so as not to create any unnecessary confusion. But anyways, Ismail Enver's position as the primary networker between the civilian organizers in the Sacred Committee in Salonika and the military men of the Third Army in Monastir would place the young Enver in a uniquely powerful position leading up to 1908. Another important young officer who would be drawn to the CUP leading up to 1908 was the Adjutant Major Ahmed Niazi. Along with Enver, Ahmed Niazi would be the other most important junior officer to publicly defect to the opposition, leading a band of mutinous soldiers and volunteers into the hills in July of 1908. And as we'll see, Niazi will actually be the first officer to take decisive action against the Sultan when he raids his local garrison in Monastir for weapons on July 3rd. So it can be argued that the defection of Ahmed Niazi marks the beginning of the Young Turk Revolution proper. So let's put Ahmed Niazi onto the board. Ahmed Niazi was born in 1873 in the town of Rezin, which lies just to the west of Monastir, where Enver grew up. When Ahmed Niazi was born, Rezin lay in the heart of Albanian country, and Niazi's father was a Muslim Albanian aga, which was something equivalent to a powerful feudal lord. Now, even though we have not yet covered the Albanian story within a separate series, individual Albanians have already played major roles in our overall narrative. And as the largest ethnic population of Muslims in Macedonia, Albanians would play a critical role in the revolution proper. So let's take a second to talk more specifically about the Albanians and the important roles that they have already played and will continue to play within our story. Now, you may remember that CUP founder Ibrahim Timo was an Albanian who had originally gotten his start in politics as an activist in Ottoman Albania amidst the chaos of the Russo-Turkish War of 1877-78, during which the continued existence of Ottoman rule in Albanian lands was seriously threatened. This period in Albanian history, during the Russian invasion of Ottoman Europe, is typically called the League of Prizren, and basically, the Albanian lands of the empire would briefly form a near-independent Albanian federation as Albanian chieftains came together to protect their lands from the threat of the Russians and from the threat of the emergent Christian nation-states of the Balkans, Serbia, Montenegro, Greece, and Bulgaria. So, the League of Prizren was essentially a defense pact formed by Albanians in 1878 in response to the great power scheming at the Congress of Berlin, where the interests of the Slavic nation-states were privileged over that of the Albanians, who were pretty much ignored, meaning that the League emerged as a direct result of the fact that the Ottoman Sultan seemed completely unable to defend Albanian lands from the invading Orthodox Christians and from great power partition. CUP founder Ibrahim Timo had played an important role during the League of Prizren, as he helped to found one of the earliest societies dedicated to formulating a standardized Albanian alphabet. After the League of Prizren collapsed in 1881, when the Ottoman army suppressed the League due to its increasingly nationalistic character, Ibrahim Timo moved to Istanbul and later founded the CUP. In the early years of the CUP, Ibrahim Timo was arguably the most important leader of the organization, right up until the mass exodus of Young Turks to Europe in the mid-1890s, after which time Ahmed Reza and his circle of intellectuals would eclipse the early founders from Istanbul like Ibrahim Timo. But Ibrahim Timo, he was an important Albanian intellectual active during the critical League of Prizren, and then later on, he became a principal founder of the CUP. And then another Albanian in the Young Turk movement was Ismail Kemal, the important delegate at the First Congress of the Ottoman Opposition, who would one day go on to become the founder of the independent Albanian nation-state in 1912, and who, at the Congress of 1902, was one of the strongest voices arguing in favor of a great power intervention, standing against Ahmed Reza and alongside Prince Sabahani. In his early years as an Ottoman administrator, Ismail Kemal had also supported the movement to develop an Albanian alphabet, though Kemal would be exiled in 1877 due to his association with Midhat Pasha, meaning that he was not present for the League of Prizren. But what these two individual stories of Ibrahim Timo and Ismail Kemal show us is how the budding movement of Albanian proto-nationalism had, for many decades now, become somewhat intertwined with the Ottoman opposition movement against Sultan Abdulhamid more generally. And in understanding exactly why Albanians would play such important roles in the so-called Young Turk movement, what we need to keep in mind is that while there were some people calling for Albanian independence during the League of Prizren period when Albanians got their first taste of self-rule, many, many more argued for Albanian autonomy within the Ottoman system, and then just as many wanted the Sultan to just do a better job of defending their lands from foreign invasion. In short, Albanian proto-nationalism in its early days was not inherently opposed to the Ottoman Empire. And in a lot of ways, Albanian proto-nationalists were some of the most patriotic Ottomans, or in other words, they were some of the most avid supporters of Ottomanism. The reason for this support of Ottomanism was twofold. On the one hand, Ottomanism was all about guaranteeing the rights of all minority groups, which was great. But then, on top of this, within the Ottomanist program, it was assumed by most people that even though all minorities would be guaranteed fundamental rights, Muslims would still represent the so-called dominant element. Albanians were a Muslim minority group. So, in a lot of ways, Albanians and other Muslim minority groups like the Kurds had the most to gain in the Ottomanist program, because as Muslims, they would still remain in the dominant group, and as ethnic minorities, they would also be guaranteed fundamental rights within a new constitutional regime. So, this is all to say that many Albanians, like the young adjutant major and future revolutionary officer, Abed Niazi, would join up with the CUP in the hopes of saving their empire through the establishment of a constitutional monarchy that would, number one, end Hamidian despotism, which everyone hated at this point, and number two, it would inaugurate a new age of Ottomanism. The reason I am kind of hammering this point is because we have noted a few times now how Turkism had begun to emerge within the intellectual movement surrounding Ahmed Reza. But even though this is true, Turkish nationalism and Albanian nationalism were still very early in developing, and Ottomanism, as well as just like Muslim unity, were at this point the driving ideologies for most patriotic Muslims who lived within the empire and who sympathized with the revolutionary opposition. For now, ethnic nationalism was just much less important than Ottomanism for most of these patriotic Muslims. The young officer, Ahmed Niazi, was a prototypical example of one of these patriotic Albanian Muslims who avidly supported the Ottomanist program. And in the 1890s, Ahmed Niazi would increasingly come to sympathize with the Young Turk opposition movement operating in exile under the leadership of Ahmed Reza. Niazi was several years older than many of his future comrades like Enver and Mustafa Kemal. This meant that Niazi got to take part in the Greco-Turkish War of 1897, and he would fight with distinction and help the Ottoman army earn this much-needed victory over the Greeks. In demonstrating his growing fame as a war hero, Sultan Abdulhamid actually asked Niazi to become one of his aides-de-camps after the war. However, this offer was made at the same time that Mizanji Murad Bey and a host of other young Turks in exile were defecting en masse back to the Sultan's side. So, establishing himself as a principled patriot opposed to Hamidian despotism, Niazi followed the lead of Ahmed Reza and courageously refused Abdulhamid's offer, and elected to return home to Western Macedonia instead. After he arrived back in Ottoman Albania, Niazi would serve for a few years as an officer in charge of a company of reservists, meaning that he was not on active duty and had a bit of extra time on his hands. Niazi would use much of this free time to keep close tabs on the activities of Ahmed Reza and the other Young Turks in exile. So, Niazi followed with great interest the results of the First Congress of the Ottoman Opposition in Paris. And as a devotee of Ahmed Reza, Niazi agreed with the anti-imperialist stance of Reza, and Niazi became a staunch critic of foreign intervention of any kind. For Niazi, this opposition to European meddling was not at all abstract, as Niazi had witnessed firsthand what happens when the great powers start to get involved. To begin with, after the Greco-Turkish War, which Niazi had risked his own life in, the Ottomans had been robbed by the great powers of any reward after this hard-earned victory. And then the looming presence of the great powers had always been felt quite strongly in the Albanian lands of the Ottoman Empire. And without wanting to get too into the weeds here, the Austrians and the Italians had developed a pretty fierce imperial rivalry over the Adriatic Sea. And Albania sits right on the Adriatic coast, so the Italians and the Austrians were always scheming and subtly trying to assert their influence over prominent Albanians with the hopes that a hypothetical independent Albania might one day become an Italian or Austrian imperial satellite on the Adriatic, should the Ottoman Empire collapse. So, as a patriotic Ottoman standing against great power meddling, Ahmed Niazi kept careful track of the Macedonian struggle being fought by Christian guerrillas in his home territory, and he was very aware of the seditious activities of groups like the MRO. Niazi always carefully noted when foreign missionaries and great power consuls offered their informal support for Christian revolutionary groups, and he, like so many other Ottoman Muslims, grew to heavily resent this foreign support of Christian separatists. Then, in 1903, the massive Alinden Uprising broke out with a lot of the most dramatic engagements happening where Niazi was stationed in the area directly surrounding Monastir. During the Alinden Uprising, and in the years following it, when the Macedonian struggle became increasingly bitter, Niazi would, much like his comrade Enver, make a name for himself fighting Christian guerrillas. So, Niazi's fame as a war hero would grow even further in the 5 years between 1903 and 1908. Following the Alinden Uprising, Niazi would also begin to work more directly with the CUP and with the Ottoman Freedom Society over in Salonika, though I have not been able to nail down the exact date when Niazi was inaugurated as an official member. It seems that Enver maybe helped to bring his fellow officer Niazi into the CUP fold, but it's somewhat unclear, so if anyone has concrete information on this, please send me an email. These revolutionary officers were always operating with the utmost secrecy, which can sometimes make these little facts a bit hard to track down. But regardless of the exact date, Niazi was definitely beginning to conspire with the CUP in the years following the Alinden Uprising. In these 5 years between 1903 and 1908, Ahmed Niazi would, much like his comrade Enver, develop a reputation as a war hero fighting Christian guerrilla bands. And Niazi would, at the same time, also become involved in revolutionary activity as a member of the CUP. And as an intrepid young military leader and Muslim freedom fighter, Niazi would become very popular amongst the Albanian population of Monastir in particular. This popularity amongst his fellow Albanians largely stemmed from Niazi's courageous defense of the lives and property of Muslims living in Macedonia. And in this role as a freedom fighter defending Muslim lives and property, Niazi was actually joining a much broader movement emerging in Albanian lands, in which Muslims were beginning to form their own guerrilla bands to defend themselves against the Christian revolutionary groups like the MRO. For a bit of background, as the Macedonian struggle became increasingly bitter and violent, law and order rapidly began to break down, and Christian guerrillas were not only fighting each other, but with distressing regularity, these Christian bands had also begun to attack and plunder Muslim villages. Within this lawless atmosphere, both Albanian and Turkish-speaking Muslims began to organize their own volunteer militias in order to defend their communities from the brigandage of Christian guerrillas. And these Muslim guerrilla leaders became heroic figures for Muslim peasants and for Muslim landowners who would often hire these guerrillas as armed retainers. And as vigilante Robin Hood types executing extra-legal justice, these Muslim guerrillas took on some pretty menacing personas, with the most famous of these guerrilla leaders being a man named Hassan the Sailor, whose nickname was the Butcher of the Bulgarians. So yeah, this is what I mean when I say that the Macedonian struggle was becoming increasingly bitter. Since the failures of the Lindan Uprising and the vacuum of leadership left behind after the death of Goca Delchev, Macedo-Bulgarian bands became much less committed to the utopian project of building a multi-ethnic and inclusive state in Macedonia. So, taking on a more nihilistic ideology, Macedo-Bulgarians, as well as Greeks and Serbs, began just kind of ruthlessly plundering Muslim villages with impunity. And, well, Muslims felt they had to defend themselves, so they formed armed bands of their own. Throughout 1907, these Muslim guerrilla bands would organically begin to fuse with elements in the Third Army of Macedonia and with the CUP. As we have mentioned, the CUP, under the leadership of Dr. Shakir, had begun to prioritize neutralizing separatist groups as one of the organization's primary aims. So, the leaders of the CUP would come to see a lot of merit in recruiting these Muslim guerrilla leaders in order to achieve this aim of fighting separatists, because they were kind of already doing this. So, it would be as easy as just making the Muslim guerrillas an official part of the CUP. And these ruthless guerrillas also pretty much fit perfectly within Dr. Shakir's plan to build an army of self-sacrificing volunteers, or fedayi. In their efforts to recruit these guerrilla leaders, the CUP would take two parallel paths. First, Young Turk intellectuals like Ahmed Reza began to publish articles calling on these Muslim guerrilla leaders to direct their actions towards the higher aim of establishing a constitutional government. Reza asked guerrilla leaders to not simply attack Christian bands, but to organize in a more coordinated effort to force the Sultan to reinstate the Mithat constitution, so as to reestablish law and order in Macedonia and to bring a new level of prosperity and equality that would rid the empire of any need for such separatist groups in the first place. Then, the other development happening parallel with these calls by Young Turk emigres for guerrilla leaders to turn against the Sultan was that revolutionary officers in the empire began to coordinate with these guerrilla leaders. So, junior officers who were also members of the CUP, people like Ismail Enver and Ahmed Niazi, began to reach out to local guerrillas, and they would construct secret networks, the most important of which was called the Special Muslim Organization. Within such guerrilla networks, Albanians would play a critical role, and the majority of these irregular fighters would be Albanian-speaking Muslims, though many Turks were also a part of these groups as well. The importance of Albanians within these bands was one of the reasons why both Enver and Niazi would become such prominent leaders, because Niazi was, as we have said, ethnically Albanian, and then Enver was of mixed ethnic heritage, but he had some Albanian ancestry, and he could speak Albanian fluently. So both Enver and Niazi would act as critical points of connection, not only bringing the CUP together with the revolutionary officers in the Third Army, but their Albanian heritage also allowed them to forge connections between the Third Army, the CUP, and these Albanian guerrillas. As 1907 came to a close, the overall strategy of the CUP can be summarized in the following way. The CUP sought to create a small strike force that would be led by junior officers from the Third Army, with the two most important leaders being Enver and Niazi. And they were joined by dozens of other officers scattered throughout Macedonia. The mission of these junior officers was, number one, to fold the already existing Albanian and Turkish guerrilla bands into this CUP guerrilla network. And then number two, these junior officers would also begin to form guerrilla bands of their own that would include both lower-ranking members of the military as well as civilian volunteers who would be provided with weapons by the military men. And so, through the CUP's infiltration of the junior officer corps and through their co-opting of the informal militia networks coalescing within primarily Albanian communities, the organization aimed to establish de facto sovereignty over the rural areas of Macedonia. And to bring back a phrase we used to describe the MRO's strategy leading up to the Ilinden Uprising, the CUP was essentially constructing the MRO's state within a state. However, if the goal of the Christian separatist was to create this state within a state in order to shrug off the Ottoman yoke, the goal of the unionists in the CUP was to set up a base of operations in Macedonia, from which an assault on the Sultan could be launched in order to force the Sultan to reestablish constitutional rule, or if absolutely necessary, to depose Sultan Abdul Hamid outright. While this guerrilla network was being constructed in the rural areas of Macedonia, the CUP also continued their recruitment of young civilian volunteers in the urban areas of Macedonia as well, primarily in Monastir and Salonika. As 1907 was coming to a close, these young, self-sacrificing fedayi, newly initiated into the CUP, were now being ordered to carry out with the utmost haste the assassination of notorious public officials in the cities of Macedonia. So while Muslim guerrillas and junior officers were creating a state within a state out in the rural countryside, CUP men in Monastir, Salonika, and elsewhere were initiating a campaign of political terror against the Sultan's imperial administrators in order to further destabilize the remnants of imperial rule that did remain in Macedonia's urban centers. And then the third and final piece of the puzzle was that the young Turk intellectuals operating abroad, people like Ahmed Reza and Dr. Shakir, had begun to do everything they could to make their movement palatable for the great powers of Europe. Now, since a primary ideology of the CUP was fierce opposition to great power intervention, this last point might seem counterintuitive. However, the young Turks, especially Ahmed Reza and Dr. Shakir, were realists when it came to international relations, and they knew that it was absolutely necessary to win over great power diplomats if their revolution was going to have lasting power. And this was because the Sultan's administration had themselves launched a propaganda smear campaign against the CUP in recent years, in which the Sultan characterized the CUP as a bunch of anarchist bandits. In order to combat this negative image, the young Turks in exile put a lot of effort towards convincing powerful Europeans that the CUP represented the true will of the Ottoman people, and that they were organizing and fighting because Abdul Hamid, who I think we can all agree was the real bandit here, was squashing the will of the people. So, this was the overall strategy of the CUP going into 1908. Number one, establish de facto control of the rural areas of Macedonia through the creation of a guerrilla network led by seditious junior officers in the Third Army. Number two, initiate a campaign of political terror against the Sultan's administration through the assassination of notorious public officials. And then number three, improve the image of the CUP in the eyes of the European great powers. With this strategy in place, the CUP would continue to rapidly grow their ranks, and it is estimated that nearly 2,000 Ottoman officers had joined up with the organization by 1908. What this meant in practice is that by the summer of 1908, when Niazi and Enver would initiate their mutinies, leading their guerrilla bands into the hills, Macedonia had, for all intents and purposes, already gone over to the side of the CUP, meaning that all the pieces are now in place for a revolution, and all that is needed is a catalyst. Next week, we will get that catalyst as Great Britain seeks to compete with Austria-Hungary and Russia in Macedonia. This meddling of the British will be one step too far for the Unionists in the CUP, and it will drive the junior officers in the Third Army to mutiny. And this mutiny will precipitate the Young Turk Revolution. But before we end today's episode, we need to briefly circle back around to the Young Turks in exile and cover the events of December 1907, when the CUP, the Armenian Dashnaks, and old Prince Sabahaddin would come together one more time at the Second Congress of the Ottoman Opposition to see if this time they might be able to put aside their differences and to form a tactical alliance in opposition to the Sultan. To this day, there remains a bit of controversy surrounding who exactly initiated the process of organizing a Second General Congress of Ottoman opposition groups in 1907. Many sources state that the Armenian Dashnaks were the first to begin reaching out about the Congress. But more recent sources, including a very good book on the Young Turks by M. Şükrü Anıilı, has pointed to some pretty compelling evidence that Ahmed Rıza actually made a trip to Geneva and approached the Dashnaks about forming a tactical alliance with the CUP. And by the way, Anıilı is a great resource if you are interested in diving further into the Young Turks. His two books, Young Turks in Opposition and Preparation for a Revolution, have been super useful for me. But anyways, most sources state that the Dashnaks initiated this Congress, while Anıilı argues convincingly that it was Ahmed Rıza who began the talks. The main reason that a certain level of mystery still shrouds these initial negotiations is because the negotiations were done with the utmost secrecy in order to prevent infiltration from the Sultan's secret police, who, yes, did have many agents operating abroad. But regardless of who actually broached the topic first in 1907, the Dashnaks and the CUP had been considering a tactical alliance for years now. As we saw last week, Dr. Shakir had approached the Dashnaks about forging an alliance as early as 1905, when he first got to Paris and when he first began reorganizing the CUP. The Dashnaks had originally balked at this alliance, mostly because they were in the process of forming a separate alliance with Prince Sabahaddin and his coalition pushing for a foreign intervention. But the Dashnaks had also been wary for a long time of the CUP, not only because of their increasingly aggressive publications, which loudly denounced Christian separatist groups, like the Dashnaks, as treacherous, but also because the Dashnaks had always viewed Ahmed Rıza's circle as essentially fake revolutionaries, unwilling to take any real action. The Dashnaks had recently joined up with the radical Second Socialist International, alongside people like Lenin and the Bolsheviks, while Ahmed Rıza and his followers were a bunch of hesitant positivists, committed to a gradual evolutionary program. So there was a good deal of tension between these Armenian socialists trying to radically alter the social structure of the Ottoman Empire and these pretty conservative Muslims hoping to save the empire. But after Dr. Shakir began to reorganize the CUP in 1905 and 1906, and after he began to turn the party into an activist organization newly committed to revolutionary principles, the Dashnaks began to seriously reconsider an alliance with the CUP, thinking that maybe the Young Turks were finally ready to take some real decisive action. And after Ahmed Rıza's meeting with the Dashnaks in the summer of 1907, the pieces began falling into place for a second Congress of Ottoman opposition parties. In putting this second Congress together, the organizers had gleaned a good many lessons from the first Congress, which had honestly been destined to end in a split from the very beginning. and the three coalitions of the Congress, the CUP, the Armenian Dashnaks, and Prince Sabahadin's group, all came together under much more equal footing this time around, and they would hash out a general game plan before the Congress even convened. Now, we should quickly catch up on what old Prince Sabahadin has been up to for the past 5 years, since the first Congress of 1902. You may remember that Sabahadin had led the quote-unquote majority coalition at the first Congress, which pushed for a great power intervention to depose Abdul Hamid. And well, this stance on foreign intervention had created the great split within the opposition movement, as Ahmed Reza and the old guard of the CUP left the Congress without forming an alliance with Sabahadin or with the Armenian Dashnaks, because Ahmed Reza and crew were steadfastly against foreign intervention as a matter of national dignity. The extreme divisiveness witnessed at the first Congress made a deep impression on Prince Sabahadin, who was a pretty genuine and, like, sensitive fella. Sabahadin had grown up in extreme privilege as the nephew of the Sultan. And after hearing the bitter arguments at the Congress, and especially after hearing the testimonies of the Armenian delegates describing the immense sufferings of their people, Sabahadin basically decided that he needed to immerse himself in a deep self-study in order to better understand his empire and the predicament it was currently in. And after this sincere effort to better understand the many problems facing everyday Ottomans, Sabahadin would form an organization called the League of Private Initiative and Decentralization. The name of this league speaks to the conclusions that Sabahadin came to after his years of study, namely that the best societies seem to put an emphasis on private initiative and a decentralized government. Now, this was all wrapped up in the weird racialized pseudoscience that was fashionable at the time, and Sabahadin essentially became convinced that the Anglo-Saxons were like the globe's superior race, specifically because they put an emphasis on private initiative and decentralization. But if we set this weird worship of the Anglo-Saxons aside, you can kind of understand why Sabahadin might feel that these principles were applicable to his empire. The Ottomans had fallen behind economically, so Sabahadin wanted to encourage self-reliance and entrepreneurship, especially amongst Muslims, in order to build a more robust bourgeoisie within the empire. And then decentralization had long been a huge issue in Ottoman politics, and during the first Congress of the Ottoman opposition, the question of decentralization was probably the second most divisive issue behind that of a foreign intervention. Ahmed Reza and other members of the CUP were centralists who wanted to strengthen the state and make it more efficient and more streamlined. Sabahadin, on the other hand, came to sincerely empathize with the plight of Ottoman minorities, and his solution to this plight was decentralizing the government. Sabahadin wanted to structure the empire as a federated regime in which local provinces would enjoy high levels of autonomy and self-rule. This was essentially what the Armenians had been lobbying for ever since the Congress of Berlin in 1878, and it was also exactly what the Macedonian Christians in the MRO had been lobbying for, and it had been what many Albanians had called for during the League of Prizren period as well. So, Sabahadin was self-consciously a strong ally of the minority groups of the empire, and he would put a lot of effort towards building a coalition with specifically Armenian revolutionaries in the years following the 1902 Congress. After the Great Split at the 1902 Congress, the CUP, under the leadership of Ahmed Reza and then later under Dr. Shakir, spilled a lot of ink skewering Prince Sabahadin, and essentially accusing him of being a traitor. Shakir and Reza equated decentralization with separatism, and with the foreign meddling of the great powers. And they had every reason to connect these dots, because, as we know, autonomous rule had pretty much always been the first step towards either the splintering off of an independent nation state, or the establishment of a colonial satellite. The granting of autonomy had almost as a rule led to the loss of that autonomous territory at some point down the road. This trend could be seen going all the way back to the Serbian Revolution starting in 1804. And after Serbia, you had Greece, Romania, Bulgaria, Montenegro, Crete, Egypt, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Tunisia, and on and on and on and on. So this was the criticism leveled by the CUP against Prince Sabahaddin's program of decentralization. Essentially, the argument was that decentralization was the very thing making the Ottoman Empire vulnerable to separatism and imperialism. But even in the face of this fierce criticism, Prince Sabahaddin would argue that in his formulation, decentralization did not necessarily mean autonomy, and that the empire could still remain strong under a decentralized system. So Prince Sabahaddin would stick to his guns in the years leading up to 1908, and the prince spent most of his time writing open letters to European diplomats calling for an intervention, and he worked at length with Armenian groups to organize rebellions out in eastern Anatolia. So, with Sabahaddin and the Armenian Dashnaks still pushing for a decentralized state, and with Ahmed Reza, Dr. Shakir, and others in the CUP still pushing for a centralized state, you can already guess where the debates would inevitably lead during the Second Congress of the Ottoman Opposition. However, even though there would be some fierce disagreements between the CUP and the Dashnaks, most of the representatives at the Congress genuinely wanted to leave the Congress with a working alliance. So, compromises were made, and the Dashnaks, the CUP, and Prince Sabahaddin's group came out of the Congress agreeing on some shared goals. The Congress delegates agreed to, number one, force the Sultan to abdicate. Number two, to dramatically alter the present government and to establish a constitutional regime. And then, in pursuit of these two overarching goals, they all agreed to use armed resistance to encourage labor strikes and the non-payment of taxes, to spread further propaganda throughout the military, and to work to foment a general rebellion. Of course, none of these shared goals actually addressed the core disagreements between the three parties, specifically that of whether the new revolutionary government would further centralize or further decentralize. And this will become a problem later on, as the revolution will be fought in the name of Ottomanism. But Ottomanism meant a lot of different things to a lot of different people. For Christian Macedonians and Armenians, and for many Muslim Albanians as well, Ottomanism promised further autonomy for the component parts of the empire. This vision of autonomous regions controlled by the minorities of the empire was inherently a decentralized vision. On the other hand, core members of the CUP, especially those who are about to lead the revolution, like Shakir, Nazım, Talat, and Enver, wanted more than anything to strengthen the empire so that the Ottomans could fend off the existential threats of European imperialism and Balkan nationalism. For these CUP men, the Unionists as they would come to be called, the best way to strengthen the empire was to centralize. The government was incredibly fractured already as a result of the separatist movements amongst Macedonians, Greeks, Armenians, etc. And this was in fact the main reason why the great powers could push the Ottomans around. For the core members of the CUP, the Unionists, the empire needed to forge a new Ottoman identity that was unified and in which people would leave their different ethnic identities behind them. And one way you can think of this is that those dreaming of a decentralized state thought of Ottomanism as promoting essentially what we might think of as hyphenated identities, like Ottoman-Armenian or Ottoman-Albanian, whereas Unionists wanted one unified Ottoman identity that would sweep away all other ethnic identities. So, going into 1908, there would be these two pretty much directly opposed understandings of Ottomanism, And this divide over decentralization versus centralization would lay at the heart of future divisions that would emerge following the revolution. But all that being said, as 1907 came to a close, the Unionists in the CUP, the Armenian Dashnaks, and Prince Sabahaddin did establish a tactical alliance in opposition to Sultan Abdulhamid. And so, as the momentous year of 1908 dawns, the revolutionary camps were, at least in theory, all aligned in their shared opposition to the Sultan. Practically speaking, the Second Congress of the Ottoman Opposition was really only important in that it foreshadowed these future divisions that would open up after 1908. Because, in the end, the decisions of the Congress would not play a major role in driving events during the actual revolution. As we will see next episode, the revolution will be the work of the Sacred Committee of the CUP, specifically Talat, Nazim, and Shakir, together with the revolutionary officers in the Third Army of Macedonia, specifically Ahmed Niazi and Ismail Enver. And so, next week, we will get to that fateful year of 1908, and as the scheming of the great powers ramps up once more, and as the sovereignty of Macedonia is threatened yet again, Ahmed Niazi, Ismail Enver, and their fellow officers would decide that decisive action needed to be taken to save their fatherland. And they would form revolutionary bands, and they would take these bands to the hills. And their mutinies would set off a cascade of events that would culminate in July of 1908. Because there is just something about July that has a way of forging a revolutionary mood, as the Young Turks would join their revolutionary ancestors from America and from France as they set out to change the course of history. So join me next time as we finally get to the Young Turk Revolution.